Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Collaboration, Working Smarter in a Recession. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Morten Hansen is a management professor at UC Berkeley School of Information and at INSEAD in France. Formerly, he was a professor at Harvard Business School for a number of years, where he taught leadership, general management, and corporate change in the MBA and executive education programs. Professor Hansen's research is focused on collaboration, on innovation, corporate transformation, and building great companies. His research has been published in leading international journals, including Administrative Science Quarterly, Strategic Management Journal, Organizational Science, and many, many others. He's the winner of the 2005 ASQ Award for having made exceptional contributions to the field of organizational studies. Professor Hansen has published several best-selling articles in Harvard Business Review, and his managerial research has been covered by the New York Times, Business Week, Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. He's also the winner of the 2005 Sloan Management Review PricewaterhouseCoopers Award for the management article that has contributed most significantly to the enhancement of management practice. He's a native of Norway. Professor Hansen holds a master's degree in finance from London School of Economics and a PhD in business administration from Stanford University, where he was a Fulbright Scholar and the recipient of the J. Dickey Award given to outstanding PhD student performance. In addition to his academic career, Professor Hansen has also been a senior management consultant for a number of years in the London, Scandinavian, and San Francisco offices of the Boston Consulting Group. He consults regularly to large global companies in the U.S. and Europe and is a noted speaker at senior executive and in-company conferences. Will you please join me in welcoming Morten Hansen?
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for coming. It's a great pleasure to see all of you here on this fantastic topic of collaboration. I would like to start out with a story that illustrates the importance of collaboration. So let's start out in 2001, when Steve Jobs, down in Cupertino, launched the iPod. The world had no idea that this was coming. It was not announced ahead of time, as Apple does it, and it was an instant success. Now, take your mind back to 2001 and ask yourself the question, which company should have done this instead of Apple? Sony. What was Sony doing? Sony was not on the market at the time, yet they invented this category of portable music players. But Sony was not sitting still. In 2003, they did come out with their product, and it was called Sony Connect. Let's take a look at what this was.
McDonald's and Sony Connect are hooking up for the greatest music deal in history. Every time you buy a Big Mac meal, you get a free song. Just go to connect.com to get your access to hundreds of thousands of hot tracks.
Sony Connect. How many here have used or bought Sony Connect? Show of hands. One. Actually, you're the second person in my speaking circle. The first time he asked, you know, I asked him why, and he said, well, I used to work for Sony, so I had to. So I don't know your story. Okay, right. So this one came out, and it was panned in a review by Wall Street Journal, saying basically, quote, this product stinks, end of quote. And they put it back on the market, took it out of the market, and then re-engineered it and put it back on, and still no takers. And then in 2007, they terminated it. So they could not respond effectively to Apple iPod. And the question is why? So if you go back to 2003 and you look at Sony, they had all the pieces in place. They had the music division. They had Sony electronics division. In fact, they supplied the miniature batteries to the original iPod. and they had the Sony Violine on computers, and they had already experimented with hard disk players, and they already had online pilots of music sales up and running. So how come that they couldn't put these pieces together? They were all there, yet they could not do it. And if you go back and you look at Sony, the problem was silos. It turns out that about five divisions needed to work together to make this happen. But the problem was that in Sony, they have cultivated a culture of internal rivalry and competition. And that's not necessarily bad. If you have standalone products, we don't need to collaborate. That works out well. But this was a different ball game, and they could not do it. As Howard Stringer, the head of Sony, said, it's impossible to communicate with everybody when you have that many silos. So if you look at this, they could not collaborate and they could not compete in the marketplace. Had they had effective collaboration, the outcome could have been very, very different. But if you look at the numbers, as this slide shows, this is the Sony sales. And this is a boom market where the audio division is experiencing declining sales. And then if you look at the iPod and iTunes sales going from zero to $10 billion in less than 5 years. Very different outcomes. And collaboration is not the only factor explaining this, of course, but it's a key factor explaining the difference between these two outcomes. So this story kind of sets a stage for us to ask the question, how do we collaborate correctly to get the results and avoid the fate of Sony? Now that turns out, in all my research over the last 15 years on this topic, to be complicated. Because if you look at collaboration, there is clearly an upside. It has all these benefits. Cross-unit innovation, better sales, lower cost, if you can work effectively across units. For example, in one of my studies in Hewlett-Packard, we investigated product development teams. And those teams that collaborated well did 30% better than those that did not collaborate. So that is a clear upside. And I would argue that in today's environment, recessionary environment, this is even more important than in other times, because you cannot have the luxury of leaving extra performance on the table. Collaboration, in essence, is about doing more with the resources you have. It is to bring in together the resources to achieve better innovation, sales, and cost, provided you can do it correctly. The problem is, there is a downside. So if you look at the downside, it has all these factors: time drain, fighting, lack of focus, bottlenecks. We've all been there. We've all gone to meetings. And we sit there in the meeting and we scratch our heads and we ask the question, why am I here? What's the value of this meeting? Have you thought about the benefit we're going to get from putting all these resources together? Perhaps not. And we walk away and we say this was a waste of time. In one high-tech company here in the Valley, I spoke to an R&D engineer, and he told me he had to have sign up for more than 50 people outside his unit to move the product forward. Created bottlenecks, it was ineffective, and it didn't come to market. If you look at the Hewlett-Packard study, those that could not collaborate well, they did 30% worse than those that didn't collaborate at all. In other words, bad collaboration is worse than none at all. So how do you solve this challenge? And that is really what my book is about and what I'm going to talk about today, how we can solve this challenge of getting the upside and avoiding the downside. And there's a right way to collaborate and there's a wrong way to collaborate. And the idea of collaboration, it's not about the more the better. In fact, I believe there is in business today, over the last 20 years, we have preached the gospel that teamwork is good, collaboration is good, breaking down silos and communicating more is good. And I would argue that is not necessarily the case. Because as a leader or as an entrepreneur, as a principal of a school, as a school administrator, as a government official, your challenge is to separate the good from the bad and getting the upside and avoiding the downside. Otherwise, you're going to undermine your own performance. And this holds in business, in large companies like Sony, and in startups, and in nonprofit, and in government. So what is the solution here? My concept that I'd like to introduce is the idea of disciplined collaboration. And the first word is as important as the second word. So what is this disciplined collaboration? It really is three parts. The first one is spot the barriers. You first have to understand what is going on in your situation and why people are not working well together. And your situation can be very different from your situation. It differs depending on the organization or the setting we're talking about. Then, once you understand that, you have to have a disciplined tailoring of the solution that you bring to bear. Preview that. Sometimes a technology solution, a web 2.0 or social media or an enterprise 2.0 can be very effective. Other times it's just going to miss the target. And you have to understand that, particularly here in the Valley, when we talk about a lot of new IT tools coming online for enterprises, the enterprise 2.0 idea. Sometimes it works, sometimes it misses the target, depending on the barriers in question. Once you have understood that, you need to scrutinize the opportunities where you're going to collaborate and with whom, and perhaps more importantly, where not. Disciplined collaboration is to have the permission to say no to collaboration. We're not going to do that project. We're not going to go to that task force. I'm not going to do those meetings because they are not going to produce the value, the benefit. To have that permission and have rules in place for making that decision is important. All too often in companies, we see that managers are asking their employees to go and collaborate, go and sit on a task force, without necessarily have thought through what the benefit is and what the value is. And that is really the third leg of this. In a talk today, I'm going to concentrate on the first two. But if you want more information on the third one and some rules for how to say yes or no to this, it is in the book and there is a chapter there in chapter two that you can go in detail and study. But I, given the time we have together, I'm going to concentrate on one and two. So let me start with the barriers. Why do people not collaborate in business, in organizations in general, in the government, across organizations, and in startup situations? So my research suggests there are four barriers. So the first one is the not invented here syndrome. That is that we don't want input from others. We are better than the rest. We have the best solutions. Why would we ask others? That attitude is the not invented here. Where does it come from? Well, one is insular culture. We talk among ourselves. We are inward looking. So when we seek solutions, we go inside, not outside. That's one. And the other one is status gap. We are better than others. Medical doctors are better than nurses. Scientists are better than others. On and on and on. A great example I have from my research is that when Morgan Stanley acquired Dean Witter, you got the blue blood, elite, educated Morgan Stanley people suddenly have to sit in the same cubicle as the street smart Dean Witter folks. Did they like it? Not one bit. They disliked it intensely to have to deal with those lower status individuals. Another one is norm of self-reliance. We are heroes. We're going to fix it ourselves. When that norm takes hold, you don't get collaboration. And then the fourth is fear. To go and ask others for input, for help, is to reveal your ignorance. There is something you don't know. And when that sets in, you get a not invented here. So when these things are happening, you're getting the not invented here barrier. That's number one. Number two is the opposite, hoarding. Hoarding is about not willing to share information or to help others. Why would that happen? Well, competition. That's the Sony case. The divisions were in competition with each other. And when time came to collaborate, that was not the spirit. So you hoard, you protect. You sit on your turf and you protect that turf. Another more benign is too busy. We're all working 100%. I bet you there's nobody in this room sitting around saying, you know, I only work 80% and I have extra time and my inbox is all empty. So I'm just waiting for somebody to call me so I can collaborate some more. Right? Those days are gone. So if you're very busy, you just don't have the time. And you're prioritizing and you are deprioritizing some of the other collaborative activities. Then a big one is biased incentives. We are paid to do our job. We are not necessarily paid to help others. When that happens, you're not going to reach out and help others. And hoarding sets in. And then the last one is fear. Fear, if you help others, you are sharing your expertise. If knowledge is power, you're just giving up your power by sharing your expertise. So you won't do it. You become irrelevant because others know what you know. Perhaps you get fired as well. It doesn't matter whether that is objectively true or not. As long as people believe that, then they will hoard. And that's the barrier. So these four factors contribute to the hoarding barrier. And that's the second one. Now let's take a look at the third that we all know well. And that is search. We cannot easily find the information we want for the job, and we want it today, we don't want it a month from today. That is search, and it's a big barrier in many large corporations and, of course, across corporations as well. Why would search happen in a big company like, say, Sony? Well, one is size. Company goes bigger, this becomes a lot more difficult. Another one is that you're physically spread out. A consequence of outsourcing and spreading things across the globe is that search becomes more difficult. If I take a high-tech company like SAP, they used to have the R&D centers in Waldorf in Germany. Today, it is across the globe in at least 8 different places in the world. That makes it more difficult to search and find that expert that has exactly what you want. Another one, which is a paradox, is information overload. I spoke to a manager at Hewlett Packard a few years back, and he told me this. You know, a decade ago, he said, people came to me and complained that we in the headquarters didn't give them enough information. Today, they show up and saying, we are drowning in information from you guys. Okay? Inadvertently, because of the technology we have, we are able to provide people with lots and lots of information. Right? Knowledge management systems in companies provide you with all the data you need. But then the problem is to find it, to find exactly the piece that you want. Now, this is not a new problem. In the authoritative work on the Pearl Harbor attack, for example, the author concluded that the military could not detect the attack, not because it didn't have the critical pieces of information coming in. They just had too many pieces. They couldn't sort out the relevant ones from the irrelevant ones. And that's an information overload question. And lastly, with respect to search, you got poverty of networks. You're lacking professional, personal relationships across boundaries. When that is happening, it's much more difficult to search. And I will talk a little bit about that later. So that's the third barrier. Now, the fourth is transfer. Transfer is very different. This is about people who have already come together to work and to collaborate. But because they don't know each other, because they don't have the same common frame, maybe they have different educational backgrounds, maybe they speak a different technical language, whatever the reason, they have not learned to work together effectively. And that is particularly difficult if you're working on complicated things, complicated technology, tacit knowledge, things that are not plain vanilla, things that takes back and forth tight communication. And if you don't know each other, you don't know how to work together, you have a collaboration problem I call transfer. So you look across the board, there are these four barriers. Now, here is a very important point in this barrier framework. The first two barriers, the not invented here and the hoarding, are motivational barriers. People don't want to. They just don't want to collaborate. And it's very different from the other two, search and transfer, which are primarily about ability. You want to make an effort to do this. You just cannot do it easily. And this is going to become very important because the solution is going to differ depending on whether it's motivation or ability. Another important point here is that different organizations and settings encounter different barriers. Here you see an example of a large multinational high technology company. And as you can see, the barriers for this company are primarily about ability. They have search barriers and they have transfer barriers. This is their own self-assessment of a group of top managers. Now that contrasts with the other side, which is consumer goods company, where it's primarily motivational barriers. A very, very different situation. So the first task you have to do is to look at your own situation, whether you're an entrepreneur, the school principal, or managing a large company, and ask yourself, what are the barriers I am encountering in this situation? And here's one example. Like I talk about in my book, I apply this framework to the 9/11 intelligence report, the intelligence failure leading up to the 9/11 terror attack. And if you apply this framework to that extremely well-documented situation, you're looking at these set of barriers. Yes, there was a low to moderate not invented here barrier. Sometimes they didn't reach out for help or didn't reach out to ask other agencies across this vast community of intelligence agencies. There were massive hoarding barriers. Each agency's incentive structure opposes sharing. It could be a career stopper if you share too much in the FBI. There were massive search barriers. The FBI lacked the ability to know what it knew. In my reading, the last barrier was not important. The information they could easily pass around, they knew the literal meaning of that information, perhaps not its significance. So if you look at this, the key things standing out here are hoarding and search. And that is actually a very difficult situation. Suppose I put in a sophisticated IT system into this organization. What would happen? It will help with search. Would it help with hoarding? Probably not. So you got a great system in place that nobody wants to contribute to. Suppose I was the head of human resources and I said, forget the system. We need to change the way we promote and evaluate people to incentivize them to share. Suppose you put that in place and that's all you did. What would happen? You would reduce the hoarding, but they couldn't find each other because they still have search. So it's a multifaceted problem, requiring a multifaceted solution. is difficult. Very difficult. So you can see the benefit of going through the barrier framework to say, where is our problem? And that's the first part of this discipline collaboration. Now, let's move to then, once you understood your barriers, how do you tell your solutions? What can work here? What I would like to do is to look at four factors, or four things you can do. The book has some other ones, and you can look at those, but I just want to highlight four today. The goals, the leadership, the management, and the networks you may want to put in place. Let's look at the first one, goals. And let's start.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
Why is this such a great goal? In the analysis of leadership, this is probably seen as the best articulated goal ever. Why is it? Well, one is, it's a common fate goal. We all have to work together to achieve it. It is not my individual sales quota for the year. And as long as I get that sales quota, I'm fine. I don't care about the others. Not at all. Some 500 people work on the spacesuit alone. And if they fail in providing a spacesuit that could actually withstand the temperatures on the moon, the extreme temperatures, then the astronaut would die and it wouldn't be a success. So each one was a critical component. So look for common fate. That's number one. The second is simple and concrete. A man on the moon and bringing back safely to the earth. Concreteness is so important in articulating goals if you want to collaborate. There's actually a great book out there that I recommend called Made to Stick. And it talks about the power of, if you want your message across, to be concrete. And yet it is so hard to be concrete. If you look at corporate annual reports, it is to be the premier company, to be the best company, to be the best we can be. Okay? This is all vague. It is not concrete enough. In fact, when John F. Kennedy was making this goal, there's a very interesting dialogue that he audiotaped in the White House between the head of NASA at the time, James Webb, and John F. Kennedy. Because Webb, he didn't want a man on the moon. He wanted preeminence in space as the goal. So this quote from that dialogue. President Kennedy, everything that we do ought to really be tied into getting onto the moon ahead of the Russians. James Webb, why can't it be tied to preeminence in space? I'd like to have more time to talk about that because there's a wide public sentiment coming along in this country for preeminence in space. President Kennedy, if you are trying to prove preeminence, this is the way to prove preeminence, I in the moon program. Those activities that are not essential to the lunar program that help contribute over a broad spectrum to our preeminence in space are secondary. End of meeting, and he walks out of the room. Very clear language. Concreteness is about getting the man on the moon. Preeminence is too vague. It doesn't have the same power. So what they wanted was U.S. world leadership. That means preeminence in space. The way to show it is a man on the moon. And we remember that on the 40th anniversary last month because of that concreteness. So look out for common goals that are concrete. The second is passion. You have to steer passion. You can't just hit the head, you have to hit the heart. And that's how you galvanize people. Again, the same thing about the man on the moon. And then the fourth one is, if you're going to articulate a competitive goal, put it outside your company or an organization. Competition outside, not inside. Sony forgot about that one. Okay? The preeminence in space, the man on the moon, was all about beating the Russians. You couldn't say that in the goal. It didn't sound the same to say, put a man on the moon ahead of the Russians and bring him back safely to the earth. Okay? That's more difficult to say. A lot of times in companies, we devise competition among units. The regional sales office in San Francisco tried to outdo the Los Angeles, tried to outdo the Texas one, and see who's going to win. And that's great for competitive spirit, but it's not so great for collaboration. But these are complementary forces. They are not opposites. You can have competition on the outside and collaboration on the inside. That's how sport teams win. And that's how organizations should win too and not get confused like Sony did. So these are the principle of a powerful unifying goal that helps collaboration. So here's a question. Which, if you can articulate this kind of goal, what barriers does it bring down? If you are a unifying, compelling goal like the moon goal, what barriers does it bring down? The motivational barriers. People get motivated. They will set aside their own agendas and step forward. And that's the power of this. So I urge you, if you're in a situation where you need to collaborate, first ask the question, what is our common unifying goal and is it compellingly articulated? That's half your battle. So that's the first lever you can deploy. Let's take a look at the second one. Here's some examples that you can look at in the book of the levers, the goals. So let's take a look at the second one, leadership. And since we are in California, I'm going to start out with Arnold Schwarzenegger, our governor. So you may recall this story, came to power in 2003. Do you remember what happened in 2004 when it was a fight over the budget? What did the governor do? Did he collaborate or did he do something else? Well, he decided to bring that Terminator approach to fighting the Democrats over the budget. So 2004 came along, and that was the election year of Kerry against Bush. And he starts deploying pretty inflammatory language and bringing the ammunition to the battle with the Democrats. In the National Republic Convention, this is what he said.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
Okay, is that going to get collaboration? Obviously, it didn't. You may remember the story. This is what happened. They passed the budget. The next year, it got even worse. He put four proposals on the ballots, and they were all soundly defeated. And his approval rating went from the 60s and low 30s. And then what did he do once that happened at the end of 2005? He made a U-turn. To his credit, he made a U-turn. And he started collaborating with the Democrats. And this is what he said at the State of the State Union in January.
I've thought a lot about last year and the mistakes that I've made and the lessons that I've learned. And what I feel good about is that I led from the heart. Now, it is true that I was too much in a hurry. I didn't hear the majority of Californians when they were telling me they didn't like the special election. I barreled ahead anyway when I should have listened. I have absorbed my defeat and I've learned my lesson. And the people who always have the last word sent a clear message. Cut the warfare, cool the rhetoric, find common ground and fix the problems together.
Well, nice words. But as you remember, he's put it actually into action in 2006. Perhaps not beyond 2006, but at least in 2006. Working with Democrats, and he was lucky. He had some great leaders on the other side, particularly Fabio Nunes, the state speaker. And as you remember, they were sitting in Arnold's smoking tent, puffing cigars and solving some really important problems. And in 2006, they were able to work together to pass the minimum wage law and the greenhouse gas bill and the massive infrastructure bill. These are thorny issues. They were difficult issues. But it was done in what I would characterize as a collaborative leadership style. And what does that mean? That is a style that really has three dimensions. The first one is you have to have the ability to step out of your own selfish agenda and look for common ground and redefine success as not being only about your goals, but about the common goal. That entails compromising. It entails seeking actively common ground all the time. I would give credit to the governor for actually doing that part and doing it fairly well. The second part is to involve others, bring them in early on in the decision-making process, not just come up with a solution and then hand it down. Because if you don't do that, you don't get the buy-in from others and you don't get their input. That's a second dimension. Now, if everyone is involved in making decisions, the question becomes, who is responsible? The problem with collective work is that people can shirk, they can free ride. So you need to combat that with a high level of accountability. Just because you're collaborating means that you're not dissolving the accountability part. Carlos Ghosn, when he took over Nissan, near bankrupt in 1999, he announced a turnaround plan with three crystal clear metrics. And he said, if we do not achieve this plan within 3 years, I will resign. And then he added, and so will the executive committee with me. Now that got their attention. Everybody was in this together, and they were judged on reaching those. Accountability was very high. So you need to have all these three in your leadership style to get collaboration going. Now, how common is this style? Do we see it at all? And we've done some research on this to look. And if you look at the first one, in a sample of well-performing managers, about 30% were able to redefine goals. And only about 25% were able to be involving others in the process. And then accountability, you had 40%. But here's the kicker. If you take the ability to do all three together, only 16%, about 1 in 5. So we should ask of our leaders, do they have this style? So in my course at Berkeley, I asked my students to rate President Obama on these items. And they rated him very highly on all three. I don't know if that's a halo effect or that was real or not. But you could see that what he is doing is trying to find common ground and to involve others. And he's pretty good at accountability. I would say he's a leader that exhibits this style to some extent. And, of course, the test now is right before us, is the healthcare, very thorny issue. Or can he do it for this style, or is it going to be a style that is very different? The punchline here is you need this kind of style in our leaders, in yourself, if you want to lead collaboration. And that's the second lever that you have to cultivate that kind of collaborative style. And that's the second one. Now, let me move on to the third one, which I call T-shaped management. Let me illustrate that with a very brief case. At Harvard Business School, where I was teaching in the MBA program, we have a wonderful case written by Professor Diane Burton called the Rob Parson case. And Rob Parson is an investment banker who's up for promotion to the coveted position of managing director in this very prestigious firm. And then they do a performance evaluation of Rob Parson. This is actually real. The name is disguised for obvious reasons, but the case is real. And the performance evaluation is as follows. On his individual performance, in his individual numbers, they are stellar. He has increased market shares. His clients love him. He has excellent knowledge of the market. He's hitting his numbers every time and above the numbers every time. Wonderful. The problem was that the year before, they have instituted a value of teamwork, of collaboration, and they started measuring people on that by getting input from colleagues and peers. And they rated Rob Parson. And he was awful. Lacks team player skills, very difficult to work with, difficulty collaborating. Selfish, a bully. So if you want to plot him on this little 2x2 here, he's up there. He's what I call a lone star. He is a star because he's so good at bringing in the money. But he is not good at working with others. He can do one thing extremely well, not the other. So the case is at Harvard is, well, should you promote this guy or not? And that creates a big debate because he's good on one thing and bad on the other. It's not clear cut. It turns out the answer to the case is that they didn't promote him the first year. Now, the opposite is to be a butterfly. And that is somebody who's very good at collaborating. They love going to task forces. They love traveling to the next seminar in the company. They sit on committees. They're everywhere. But you look at the numbers and they're not so good. They're the opposite of the Rob Parson. So you have those two, and then, of course, you have the ones who cannot do anything of this. And then you have the best one, which I call T-shaped management. And why do we call it T-shaped? Well, because if you take these two dimensions, one is the individual vertical performance. You can do your own things really well, focusing on your job, prioritizing reaching your objective. That's a vertical part of your T. And then on the other, you have cross-unit contribution. You're working across the company. And the idea is to do both. And here you will see that to do this in a company is extremely difficult because, in essence, you need to re-engineer the human resource strategy as follows. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but I'm just going to highlight you need to change your how you pay people, how you promote people, how you fire people, and how you recruit people on two dimensions. Number one, their individual performance and the ability to collaborate. So that's T-shaped management. I think you see it on the rise across corporate America. IDEO, Cisco, IBM, Goldman Sachs are companies that are doing some sort of T-shaped management, holding people responsible for two performances. And that's T-shaped management at its best. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to very briefly touch on the last thing, and then we'll open for Q&A. And that is your network. Now, in my book, I talk about six rules for effective networking. And the punchline is that you need to build a nimble network, not a bloated, not a large network. Because a large network will take too much time for you. You can go to lunches and go to meetings all day long and do nothing but networking. And then you're not getting your job done. So I'm just going to mention one critical rule that research has shown that is very important here. And let me illustrate with this guy called Vivian Nevo. I don't know if you know this guy. He's a media investor, and nobody knows him, and that is his power. But he has this amazing ability to network. Mr. Nevo has an uncanny ability to network, the New York Times. We shortly became best buds. Rich Parson, chairman of Time Warner, meeting him at a duck pond in Sun Valley of the conference there. We just started talking and developed a nice rapport. President of Goldman Sachs, meeting him at a presentation. He is everywhere all the time like no one I have ever seen. Editor of Vanity Fair. So what is the secret of this guy that he can do this so well? And the secret lies in the fact that he walks in different worlds. He has a plug-in in the Silicon Valley, in the financial world, in the media firms, with artists, and in Hollywood. His network derives its power not because it's so large, but because it's so diverse. So diversity trumpets size in networking. And that means that if you want to have a network like this guy, you need to think about different contexts to different people, not about just meeting the same kind of people all the time. Different experts, different customer groups, different trends, different people, demographics, young and old, conservative, orthodox, whatever, and different industries, and not just limited into your own narrow domain. Diversity is the way you build a network, not through size. That's the Vivian Nevo story. And that's one of the rules of the six rules of effective networking. So putting all of this together, A unifying goal really reduces motivational barriers. So if you have motivational barriers, a unifying goal is very powerful. Same thing with collaborative leadership. It stimulates motivation. Then you got T-shaped management. It is powerful because it reduces all four levers. People are more motivated to collaborate, and they know how to do it because they built a network across. Networks, though, are primary ability. It helps us search, and it helps us work with others. Not necessarily motivating. I haven't spoken so far about IT tools. But here's an argument I make very often, and I have some interesting discussions with people in Silicon Valley, and I argue that IT tools primarily help the search barrier. Maybe also the transfer barrier, depending on your tool. I have not yet seen a powerful IT tool that reduces the motivational barriers. And it may be there's a pot of gold here for Silicon Valley to come up with that, but I have not seen it. And that is something that people ought to work on. But of course, the punchline is, if you have motivational barriers, IT tools are not going to solve your problem, at least according to this framework. That might change as we get more powerful tools, but not so far. So as you look at this map, it tells you where are my barriers and where are my solutions. That's discipline collaboration at its best. I said I was not going to talk about select opportunities. The rule there is know when to collaborate, know when not to. And that is a critical part of that. And there is a chapter in the book about how to do that. I'm just going to finish off with a couple of successes and not just say that collaboration is bad. If you want to look at benchmarks or great successes, Procter & Gamble is one. If you look at a lot of their brands, they come out of internal collaboration by recombining different technologies into a new product. There's a lineage of at least 12 of their brands that are $1 billion or more based on internal collaboration. Very powerful system that they have put in place. Wells Fargo, expert at cross-selling. It's a number of products per customer, and they're the highest in the industry. And notice, it goes up every year. The last I heard is that now it's 5.8. And notice also in the last recession, 01 to 02, it still went up. This is very powerful because it's cheaper to sell to existing customers if you can collaborate than to acquire new customers. Another example of a great upside. And the upside comes really in innovation, as I said, customer value, and in efficiency through cost-cutting in business. And these are powerful tools in a recession. So I'm going to stop there. Spot the barriers, tailor the levers, select the opportunities. That's the right way to collaborate. And let's remember, everyone, that the goal of this is not collaboration, but it's great results. And there's a right way, and there's a wrong way, and that's our challenge for all of us. Thank you very much.
So we've been listening to Morten Hansen of UC Berkeley and INSEAD in France talking to us about collaboration and sharing some tremendous insights. And so we'll move into some questions and answers here, and I guess I'll lead off, and then those in the audience, please raise your hand if you do have a question you'd like to ask. I'm particularly intrigued by the leadership aspect again, and I appreciate that you had a lot to cover in a short period of time there. But I just wondered if you'd perhaps elaborate a little more. I'm particularly interested in this notion of the bad collaboration, where it kind of implies people being pushed into it, and at least that's one of the things it seems like could lead to bad collaboration. And good collaboration might result because people are pulled into it in terms of they want to, the motivational aspects. But I was just interested if you could maybe elaborate a little bit on some of the additional roles of leadership in terms of setting the right conditions and creating the right environment, whether it be letting people know that we often hear to fail is okay, as long as we don't keep doing it, of course. But what are just some of the other things, perhaps, that you talk about in the book, but the role of leadership in setting the right conditions that encourage people, that incentivize them, in perhaps heart and brain ways to that this collaboration is a way to go.
Yeah, I think that for a leader, they first need to, number one is to ready the organization, change the incentive system so that that is conducive to collaboration. I think that's the one thing that leaders need to do, and putting the right IT tools and all of those things. But they also need to do a second thing, which is equally important, and that is to put in place a rule that says you have permission to say no when you don't think the value is there. And that is a vastly different rule from saying, I want everyone to collaborate, collaboration is a good thing, I just want you to do more of it. It's a very different leadership. It's more nuanced, and it's easy to get wrong. I spoke to the CEO of Roche, who just acquired Genentech, and he told a story when he put in collaboration in Roche, the pharmaceutical company, in the R&D organization, but he didn't want collaboration in the sales organization. But the salespeople looked at the language and they said, oh, this probably means we should collaborate too. And that was not an intent. So he got over-collaboration in sales and had to kind of scale back. And those are kind of cases that you come across that you have to kind of fine-tune as you go along. But that's what I think a leader needs to do, number one and number two. Ready the organization, and number two, set the rule that you have to say no and really look for the value. So it's very different.
Other questions from the audience?
If you have the freedom to say no, how do you then maintain the collaborative environment and the sentiment that everyone is really working together?
So the question is, how do you have the freedom if you also had the permission to say no? So that's why you need to instill, for example, hand in hand with the no rule, you also need T-ship management, where you're holding people responsible for doing both things, but only when there is value. So it's not okay to say no to a project that had immense value. It is not okay to say, no, I don't need any help, I can do it all by myself, when in fact you should have asked for help. And that's a judgment part, but you need to have that kind of balance between the two. In companies where there is a lot of value by working across boundaries and units, it is not permissible to do nothing. I don't think you have that luxury anymore. You're going to get that synergy, but you got to do it in a disciplined fashion. It's a balance between overdoing and underdoing it, I think.
So Wikipedia, it's a collaborative tool that's growing in popularity and it's being adopted within companies. Can you talk a little bit about what you see is happening there?
So there's a question about mass collaboration of contributing to a platform like that. It's a terrific product. I use it all the time, so I can see the power of it. But they have solved, in some sense, people are not hoarding because they are contributing. So that's part of it. Now, I'm not an expert in Wikipedia, but I believe there is a process by which you vet the input and they're screened. So there is a quality process component to it. Right, so you're not sort of trying to protect your own turf. So they have solved the two motivational problems, and they also solved the search problem because there's a common platform. So that's why I think it's very powerful. Notice they don't, so far, don't have a transfer problem because all they need to do is to write, not code, but words, and they kind of solve it. But they have clearly solved three other barriers, so I think that's one of the reasons why it's very powerful.
You talk a lot about the collaboration or lack thereof collaboration in the enterprise. But if you look at the consumer side of what's happening in the world today, there's so many collaborative tools that are changing the way it's really forcing enterprise to change. I mean, do you feel that's part of the challenge today, that there's not real good collaborative tools in the enterprise to help break down those barriers?
So you can extend this paradigm of collaboration to including consumers and customers. And that is already happening. And I believe there are a number of companies that have done this way before the online tools came about. Intuit, for example, has always gone and lived with its customers. A technique they took from Procter & Gamble, they go and live with households to see their needs and what products they use or might need. Living with your customers is a way of collaborating and bringing your customers in to the process. Online tools can scale that, can make it even more powerful. But of course, the tools need to be there. But I go back to the barriers. You also have to solve the search barrier, finding the relevant consumers, and the motivational barriers. And the tools need to tackle those things to be put in place. But I think those tools are coming along in a powerful way. We're not there yet, but it's exciting to see it.
Yeah, I had a question on networking and IT. And on the your T-shape management addressed it all four elements, and but the networking only addressed it, the search, and I can't remember the last one, and the IT only addressed search. Well, how would you mitigate borders and far travel with Web 2.0 and IT tools to address the motivational thing along your T-shape management access? Using those tools, because I can't travel as far. Using those, the T-shaped concept, how can I inspire motivation on a Web 2.0 basis and on a network basis?
So I don't think that T-shaped management is about holding people accountable through performance evaluation and promotions for them to collaborate when necessary and when appropriate. So in a large company context, it's really through the way in which you, through the HR system, more through the IT tool side. On the IT tool side, as I said, I have not yet come across an IT tool that is superb at changing people's motivations to collaborate.
How would I motivate somebody that's in South Africa? The only way I can contact them consistently is on a on an IT level, on a web-based level. How do I instill that we are all in it together, simple but concrete? How do I instill that while using networking and web?
So if that is a colleague that is in South Africa that is in part of the same company as you are, if that is the situation, then if that person in South Africa is a T-shaped person who is evaluated and promoted on the basis of collaborating, then that person will have the motivation to begin with. Now, you use the IT tools to find that person. That's a search problem. Once you found that person, if the HR system is working correctly in that company, that person will answer your phone and return your phone call because the motivation is there. But if it's one within one company, the leaders of that company has the power to change incentive system throughout the company. Whether they see it in South Africa or in Belgium or in Silicon Valley, it doesn't matter. That's the way I would do it. And that's what you see global companies do.
We're listening to Morten Hansen, a UC professor, talking to us about collaboration, some really fascinating insights. I guess I have another quick question. With regard to our multicultural society and certainly multinational countries, and I know we don't have time to get into a lot of it, but what are some of the key things that talk about, just carrying on the question here, the issues of ethnicities and cultures themselves, about finding that those common grounds of just fairness and some of the other things that cut across all these, but what are some of a couple of the big issues in that regard?
So the question is around cultural differences and collaboration. And what I found, I do a lot of teaching and a lot of talking to people in Europe and international participants, executives around in Asia as well. And what I found through those discussions is that if you look at the principles of effective collaboration, they are the same. They are not that different. Now, they may take on different tactics, the way you run your promotion system and so on in different cultural context. But the very barriers are still there. Give an example, I spoke to a company in Russia. Now, that is a very autocratic system of management traditionally. But they too have collaboration problems. They too have the same barriers and need some of the same solutions to get collaboration going. So I would say the principle are more universal than we think they are. At least that would be my sort of immediate position on it.
I think one of the really tricky relationship is collaboration and accountability. And I'm glad you pointed that out. So I spent a few years in the executive team of one of the big banks in California. And what I have seen is the barriers are actually not erected by, like, vain idiots. Very often they're actually very acting very rational in their own right. Like, person A says, I have been made accountable for improving the online presence. Person B, I need your support. Person B says, well, that's actually further down in my list, and Morten Hansen said I should focus, right? Well, mm-hmm. they didn't know you, but my top accountability goals are actually moving, improving customer experience in the branch, but I could need your help on this. Well, it's further down on your priority list that you're accountable for. Obviously, the leader needs to step in and reframe accountability in such a context. How would you, like, advise the leader to approach that when they're looking at silos like that?
So what I would advise the leader on that is exactly discipline collaboration. I mean, you're pointing to a problem in management. As I say in the book, modern management, practiced to an extreme, is the enemy of collaboration. And by that I mean that we have extreme decentralization, extreme independence, that you are responsible for your unit only, you're responsible for your office only, and that is what you're held accountable for. It's a beautiful system up to a point, because you will maximize your performance by each of the units for which you are accountable. What a leader needs to do is to reframe that system by saying that is one part of your job, but there is an additional part of your job, and that is going across the T-shape. You're responsible now and accountable for your own unit and for working across. It's a different level. It's a next level of performance that you can do not only just the units, but also working across. And that is what that reframing of accountability, of having to do work by yourself and working across, I believe that's the next wave we'll see of performance. And those few companies that can do that, they are moving the needle of performance. They're moving to the next level of performance. You follow the story of Cisco, for example. That is where they are trying to move. And if they're successful, they're going to move ahead of performance of the competitors. So that's the power of it. But it has to be disciplined, not just collaboration. That's the way I would put it.
Okay, I had a question for you. You were talking about the motivation side of things, and you said there's no technical solution for motivation. Well, what would that look like if there was? I mean, what could technology provide in terms of motivation?
So, I mean, that's a great question maybe to end this session, because I'm not an IT expert, so I'm waiting for the Silicon Valley community. I teach a course at UC Berkeley at the School of Information, and each of my students are actually technically very competent people. They have a technical background, and I challenge them. Go and find a tool you think that can address the motivational barriers. Well, last time they could not find a tool, but it might be out there. And that is, I think, the challenge to the IT community. Find those tools, develop them. That would be very powerful. I don't have an answer, but I would like to look for one.
Morten, we have reached a time, actually over time, and I'd like to give you a minute or two to, what are the one or two things that you'd have us leave with that you'd really like us to focus on? And I suppose besides buy your book and learn a lot more, but give us a couple of things that you'd real nuggets you'd like to leave us with to think about.
I think the most important for me is that the goal of collaboration is not collaboration. It is better results. And from that dictum flows the principle you need to lead with. And that is so important, because you don't want to collaborate for the sake of collaborating. That's going to lead to worse performance, not better performance. And there is a right way and there is a wrong way, and you kind of need to figure that out on the right way of collaborating. More is not better in this instance. And we need to get away from the management myth that teamwork, collaboration, communication, tearing down silos and barriers is necessarily a good thing. It isn't. It is only good if you can instill discipline, collaboration, and look at that thing of improving results and not just doing it for the sake of doing it. That, to me, is the most important punchline.
Can we put our hands together, please, for Morten Hansen? I want to thank Morten Hansen of UC Berkeley, talking to us about collaboration and providing some just really wonderful insights. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.